Okay, we'll call this meeting of the Zoning Board of Appeals to order. Will the secretary call the roll?
Mr. Swindoll? Not here. Mr. Smetana?
Here.
Mr. Rule? Not here. Ms. O'Brien?
Here.
Mr. Dombrowski? Not here. Mr. Burney?
Here.
Chairman Martin?
Here. We have a quorum?
We have four.
All right, and we'd like to welcome Mr. Smetana to the board and hope that you will enjoy this opportunity to serve the village.
Thank you.
All right, so the first thing that we're going to deal with tonight is item number five on the agenda, the variation request for 342 Park for the garage height. So everyone who's going to address the board, you need to stand up and get sworn in by the secretary, whether it's for this matter or anything else that we have before us tonight.
Ma'am, are you going to plan to address the board tonight?
Okay. To those who will testify at the public hearing, you are reminded that the River Forest Village Code makes it unlawful for any person to knowingly make a false statement of material fact to the village in connection with any application, report, affidavit, oath, certification, or attestation. Violations are punishable as a petty offense with a fine. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will give true testimony relative to the matter before this Zoning Board of Appeals?
I do.
Okay, so with that, we're ready. The applicant from 342 Park has two separate variation requests before us this evening, and we will deal with them one at a time.
Mr. Chairman, there's one clarification.
It's 346.
Thank you.
It's 346. The agenda was wrong for both, and the applications are correct for 346.
Okay. And the notice in the paper was correct.
Okay. So I won't read what's here, but we'll go with 346.
We're going with 346.
All right. And so the first thing we're going to do is ask that the applicant address the request for variation for the garage height.
Good evening, distinguished members of the Zoning Board. First, I want to start off by thanking you profusely for your time. I know you're all volunteer positions here. Being a member of a volunteer situation myself, a veteran of the United States Navy, I understand, you know, that there's a little bit of commitment involved and that sometimes your job may be thankless. So first off, thank you. Secondly, given that I've never done this before, not entirely sure how the flow of things work, but I'm not
at
sure
this point. It's you are the applicant.
Yes.
So you need to tell us what it is that you're looking for and why you think you deserve a variation from the zoning code. In this instance, we might help you by asking Mr. Raddatz if he could give us a summary of what has transpired to this point, and then we can ask the applicant to address the variation that's being requested.
And I would be happy to provide summary if that's necessary, but if you would like to, Cliff, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Kruger was originally considering constructing a garage on his property, and he desired to request a minor variation to increase the allowable height of the garage from an accessory. Under the zoning ordinance, an accessory building is allowed to be 18 feet in total height from grade being defined as the elevation at the front sidewalk to the highest point of the building. In this case, it would be the ridge of the roof. The zoning ordinance allows minor variations for a select group of features of the zoning ordinance, and it allows a variation of up to 5% above the allowed height. The minor zoning variation process is a streamlined process that can be administered by the zoning administrator and doesn't come before the Zoning Board of Appeals. after the prescribed period, having received no negative responses to the request, the zoning administrator granted the variation, which allowed the garage to be built with a height of 18.9 feet, the increase being 5%. As part of the building permit conditions, there was a condition that the applicant provide the village, at considering that it is being built to a very exact height and also to being built in excess of the normal height, we requested that a surveyor provide a measurement of the exact height of the framing of the roof prior to the request for rough inspections. At that time, it was discovered that instead of 18.9 feet, the garage is actually 18.98 feet, a difference of 8/100ths of a foot, about 0.96 of an inch, slightly less than 1 inch. Normally, there might be a discussion about whether that was a de minimis change, but given that a minor zoning variation had already been granted, village staff did not think that that was advisable to basically walk away from an extra inch. Hence, the applicant is before you this evening.
Okay, so the issue before us this evening on this variation request is whether the garage, which is less than an inch taller than it's supposed to be, whether we should grant a variation for that.
That's the request of the application. Okay. That's the necessity of standing in front of you.
Okay. Why don't you tell us, how did this come about?
So just simple error in calculation. As I said, the sidewalk is 198 feet in front of the garage, and we had a topography of the property done, and trying to follow as closely as possible as we could. I needed the extra 5% in order to be able to stand up inside of the garage, so that was the reason for the request. It didn't make sense to have storage facility upstairs and not be able to stand up. I thought it was a simple request. That said, throughout the entire process, calculated the height of everything and thought that I had it exact, and much to my aghast, they came out and did the survey, and like I said, mea culpa. Under an inch in error, I didn't think that it was going to be a problem, but here I am requesting a variation for an acceptance of said 0.96 inches over the given height. I will state that at grade from measured adjacent to the building, it is 17 feet 9 inches above grade where it stands. But yes, it is an inch over the datum established at the sidewalk.
All right, anybody have any questions for this applicant?
What is immediately behind your garage?
So if you are standing with your back at my garage, there's yet another 14 feet of my property. And then if you're familiar with the Canadian Railroad National Line that runs through Oak Park, the rear of my property abuts that. So 10 feet away from the back of the garage, it starts to incline very quickly all the way up to the railroad. So they're nothing. I don't know, that's all based on perspective, but yeah. There is a very large hill that just gradually becomes the top of the railroad line.
Thank you.
There are no other buildings. I think that's what Mr. Burke.
There are no. Yeah, I was being specific with the question. Yeah. So,
all right. Any other questions for Mr. Krueger? Anybody in the audience want to address the board on this variation request? So We'll close the public portion of the hearing, and we will make a recommendation.
I would like to say that I would like to, you know, approve this small change.
All right. Is there a second?
I'll second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that we recommend to the Village Board of Trustees that this request for variation be granted. Any discussion? Okay, you want to call the roll, Cliff?
Okay. Mr. Smetana?
Aye, yes.
Ms. O'Brien?
Yes.
Mr. Burney?
Yes.
Chairman Martin?
Yes. Okay, so this variation request will go to the Board of Trustees at a time when Mr. Raddatz or Ms. Shiner can tell you, and you will look to them to make a final decision on our recommendation.
Thank you.
So the second variation request for this property deals with Section 10.9.7 of the Zoning Code, which requires certain setbacks, and the request is to construct an addition on top of an existing wall that impinges on the required setback. So if you want to go ahead and make your presentation to us on this matter, that would be great.
So we've lived there for 3 years, and we initially moved there. We have three boys. My wife is in the audience as well. And the idea being that it was a very beautiful piece of property, and it left a lot of opportunity for us to expand there. It's not very easy, you know, monetarily moving into River Forest and then having to, like, but so that said, we had drawn up some plans to add onto the home itself a second floor, and then onto the back home of as well. And you have all of the drawings in front of you on 11 by 17 showing the addition to the back of the home, 22 by 25 deep. Or 25 wide, I'm sorry, by 22 deep. And then in addition to the top of the home, that would actually carry a non-conforming wall up from the first floor to the second floor. There is a significant amount of cost that comes in offsetting a wall from a bearing wall below. I think that if you also look at the photos, I have a photo of the home that is in accordance with the current ordinance. And I think there is a great deal of, I don't know how to explain it, just there's a lot of, it doesn't look right. It doesn't look right at all. I'm concerned about how that would throw off the aesthetics of the neighborhood, and you know, nobody wants to live in a home that looks, oh, that's that house with the unreasonable looking offset on the top of it. I'm also concerned about the loss of bedroom space in the upstairs area as well. I think we stand to lose roughly 17% of the total space upstairs that is easily usable. But with this ordinance that prohibits a lot of that use, we also have we did a sun study, and the sun study I hope reflects also that with the height that is allowable here in River Forest, which is 35 feet, and the height that we're currently contending is 32 feet, is 3 feet below. But also, if the peak of the home were that 2 feet extra to the north, that it wouldn't significantly, I would even say at all, affect the sunlight and airspace that is immediately to the north, the neighbor to the north. Anything else? So we're just requesting that we get a variation for an ordinance that will allow us to continue that north wall and build on top of the currently existing home. And there are a lot of two-story homes in River Forest, but I would beg that that this would be a very different looking home. I would also beg that there's an unnecessary hardship in building a home against standard construction, and a significant cost in the way that this would be built as well, to allow a load-bearing second floor wall span the 26 feet of from wall to wall that it would be necessary. I don't think that this would actually put any significant harm on, you know, the utilities. I don't think that it would be injurious to any of you know, the enjoyment. I would beg to the contrary that this would be something that might be injurious in the sense that it doesn't look in character, it doesn't look in harmony with the neighboring homes. I think that what we plan to do is in harmony and adds character. And I'd like to also mention that any time that you do some sort of property improvement, that it tends to add to the value of the neighboring homes.
Okay, so Mr. Raddatz, do you want to take a minute and explain to us what the situation is? I mean, there, the north wall is not the north wall encroaches on the setback. Is that correct?
That is correct. The existing home, when we're looking at the drawings, there's drawings in the from the architect A3, which is right after the sun study. The front portion of the front portion of the house is existing, which in this, you know, proposed plan is the area of dining room, living room, powder room, that part at the front. There's an addition onto the back, but there's also a second story addition. The addition to the back is set back to meet the minimum setback requirements. And at the second floor, for the part that is over the addition to the back, that is also at the, you know, at the required setback. It's that the, if you look at the second floor plan at the top of this sheet, the north side of what are labeled bedroom two and bedroom three follows the wall below of the dining room and living room, and those are the walls that maintain the, increasing the height of a wall that maintains a non-conforming side yard setback.
So if this, if the proposal was to build straight back and continue the encroachment of the setback, that wouldn't be a problem with only a one-story
at the
building.
One-story. Correct. They could have matched the setback and increased the length of the non-conforming.
But the problem comes because the zoning code does not permit, as a matter of right, a second-story addition on a non-conforming wall.
Correct.
Okay. So that's the
that is correct.
You want is,
yes,
you want us to recommend to the trustees that you be permitted to build a second story onto a wall that currently encroaches into the required setback.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Any questions?
Have you looked at any other plans or designs with this?
The other plans that we have looked at require, I mean, obviously the addition to the back of the home complies, so then the only obvious requirement would then be to conform with the code by allowing that a 2 foot, basically you come in 2 feet to meet the requirement before we add on to the second story of the home. And I did provide photos of a home that follows that compliance. And I just feel that setting a home off 2 feet from the top not only, like I said, incurs a large fee, and I'm not actually suggesting that we move the entire set, the entire second story of the home over 2 feet. We would actually have to come in with the north wall 2 feet, and to be honest, it looks very off. It looks as though someone made a mistake. And as I mentioned, in order to conform with unconventional construction costs, I think I stated they're in the range of $31,000 to $37,000 above and beyond the construction costs that already exist.
So then the orientation of the roof actually brings it out further than your existing house's roof, meaning the eaves are hanging out further.
If we were allowed the variation or without the variation?
If you're allowed the variation, the eaves are...
Then yes, the eaves...
Further out, I mean...
That's correct. Then the eaves project into that
also
3 foot space. I think 10 inches was what I had...
So there's really two requests for
that's
two
correct
variations. One is for the non-conforming wall, and the second is for the eaves.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay. What's the length of the existing house on that side?
If you're standing in front of the home, it is 32 feet wide and deep 26.
All right, 26.
Are you familiar with this sun study that your architect...
I am familiar with it.
It appears to me, as I read this, that if the variation is granted and the second floor is constructed, that the house to the north, the existing window opening on the house to the north is going to be shaded during most of the year.
Regardless of whether the variation is granted or not granted. So the peak of the home, if we were allowed and took our 35 feet as allowed.
Well, you're not allowed there. So that you
35 feet in height.
Don't argue that, because you can't do that because you can't do it as a matter of right because you've got a non-conforming setback. So the argument that you can do that as a matter of right is not correct.
I think what I'm referring to is that if we were not allowed the variation, we would still be 2 feet set, then 5 feet off of the property line,
okay,
and that the allowable height from the datum established by the sidewalk is 35 feet. Those are the two allowable things.
Right. But you've said that you don't want to.
I would prefer not to
go in the 2 feet.
I would prefer not to go in the 2 feet. I would prefer to build the load-bearing wall on top of the current non-conforming wall.
Okay.
But we are not going to be at 35 feet. We're going to be at 32 feet at the highest point, that being at the peak.
Right. Okay.
So the two dotted lines, then one of them establishes where the sun would fall at summer solstice and winter solstice at the allowable height, and then the other dotted line shows where that shadow line would fall at both of those seasons,
right,
I just mentioned. And the window that you, I think, mentioned, okay, which is immediately to the south of me, that window is shaded under both conditions.
So with the south window of the neighbor to the north.
I'm sorry, would you say that again?
Yes.
It appears to be the south window.
Yes, that's correct. I'm sorry.
Yes,
that's correct.
Okay, any other questions?
I'm curious, how would you intend to maintain that side of the property without utilizing your neighbor's property? I mean, how would you get a ladder up being so close to the property line to maintain anything on the second floor, to clear the gutters or do anything like that?
Well, that is actually a gable end, and therefore there are no gutters on that end. In order to, you know, apply the siding and such, I would obviously ask my neighbor, you know, if I could stand said ladders on her property, which I don't think will be a problem. She allowed me to set up ladders to do the siding of the north-facing portion of the garage, which wasn't a problem with her. So in terms of maintaining that side of the property, you know, there would be a request for permission to set up said ladders, and I think that, you know, any good neighbor would, and the steward of their neighborhood would also make sure that their neighbor's yard was cleaned up to the best, better than it was before they actually set up ladders to do any sort of maintenance work.
I'm just concerned that we're maybe creating a permanent situation that would be difficult to maintain as a matter of right.
So then a permit situation of painting, siding?
Anything you'd have to do on that side of the house, because there's only 3 feet of clearance on that side of the house. And a one-story structure, I could see it being easier to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
But just getting a ladder up on that side of the house,
I think you
might be creating a
You might be familiar. You might be familiar with pump jacks, and pump jacks are a very, very consolidated setup that, when necessary, they could actually be set up very, very close to the home. And these pump jacks are such that they are set close to the home. There's a very, very long plank that establish, you know, that is put on these two ends, and then the tops of the pump jacks are tied into the top of the home. So In essence, then nothing is on the neighbor's property under that circumstance. And in order to actually get that plank up, you know, there's a foot pump at each post, and this foot pump then pumps up the plank to the necessary height where it is, wherever it's needed, and then whatever work or whatever maintenance that needs to be done can be maintained without actually setting the foot of the ladder on the neighbor's home, if that should be a problem.
I have one more question. The chimney that you have here on your home, is that extended also with the up to the second story?
No, that is not actually. And what will end up happening is that will probably remain in place or be taken out. I'm not entirely sure. But what I can honestly say to that is that there are high efficiency furnaces that don't require a flue and a chimney. Then they can be power vented to wherever they need to be vented. So the chimney's actually not even necessary after the construction of this home.
Can I just clarify? Mr. Ryan's calling.
Oh, wait.
I apologize.
If you want to talk, that's fine, but you have to come up, identify yourself. And
got it.
This is my architect, Dave Mariello.
Okay. Hey, Dave Mariello. The drawings actually indicate that chimney is to be removed.
Okay.
Removed.
Mm-hmm.
And what about then the exit of the furnace and all that remains
we'll
in
power,
that position?
The side vent, your power
so you
vent.
Get the pipes sticking
yeah,
out from the house,
the
too?
Yeah, PVC flues. They go out the side wall of the house. Same thing with the water
how
heater.
How far do those protrude from the house?
You can actually get fittings that, yeah, on the order of 6 inches. Basically, they come out and turn down.
Yeah, I've seen them.
You know?
My neighbor has them on their
yeah.
house. I still have the chimney in use.
Right.
But so you would take the chimney off, and then, but then these pipes would be there too, which are not a big obstruction, but yet just a little bit more in.
Sure.
I think.
May I ask, since you're the architect, did you guys consider at all the roof orientation of slightly different, meaning to the other, so that your eaves aren't out so far? Or is that
well,
not
I mean, different roof orientation. You know, we have basically a sideways facing gable.
Yeah.
Which is like every other house on the block.
Yeah.
And really in terms of, you could argue in terms of the shadow it casts. I mean, that sun study, it's right at the peak. You know, it's not, it's actually, because the roof slopes down, the actual square footage of shade you're getting is less than what that sun study, but you know, I took it to the peak.
Mm-hmm.
Just to show it at the worst condition. So the other thing is the way the footprint of the house is, you know, sideways facing gable was just the most sensible from a construction standpoint because it's the shortest run, you know, the
shortest span.
Yeah.
Because you're adding on in the back also.
Right, with a, and that's a gable that face that runs
going
east
the other
west,
way.
Turns the other way. Yeah.
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 So if this could have been in some way turned the other way, then there would be only the wall that you would be looking for and not the eaves also, most likely. I don't know.
Yes.
I'm not that much of a designer. But
I think in just logical sense that whenever you're running, you know, a roof, you're trying to span the shortest span. So it makes sense that you run the gable north-south because you're spanning 26 feet as opposed to east-west, which you're spanning.
We just have to like
32
like
feet.
Double gable or something.
So
another one. It's just yeah. It just from a geometry standpoint, it just gets a little more complicated.
Sure.
You know, so we always try to find the simplest way.
Good. Thank you.
All right, any other questions of Mr. Krueger? Is there anybody in the audience who has signed up to address us on this matter?
No.
Anybody in the audience want to address on this matter? All right, so we will close the public portion of the hearing. Is there anything else you want to say, Mr. Krueger?
There is not. I think I've made the best possible case I can.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, so
Thank you for your time. We will consider
this and make a recommendation to the trustees. Anybody have any comments or questions?
There's 11 properties similar to this on the block. So it's not unique to me. There's 11 of them. The difference is that these two don't have a driveway between them. The corner of the house, the driveways run off the street. But it's awfully close. And if you've got 11 other houses on the block like that, I don't think it's hard to say it's unique. So I think the variation number 3 that says it wouldn't be applicable to other properties is a tough one to.
Because we have to find that that each of these standards has been met, not most of them.
Right, right, but I was just,
right.
I went and counted out the houses and then just.
Any other questions, any discussion? Everybody ready to vote?
Yeah, I think the ordinance, the idea of the ordinance back when it was passed is to get away from these houses, that if the house next door should do something and increase and everybody that we're kind of closing off any or too small of openings between and that was the idea. So I have a problem with that. I have a problem because the eave goes out even closer. So.
All right, any other discussion? Are you ready to vote? Somebody want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion to not recommend the two variations.
All right, that motion has been made. Is there a second?
I second.
All right, so it's been moved and seconded that we recommend to the Board of Trustees that this request for variation not be granted. So when Mr. Raddatz calls the roll, a yes vote is to not recommend and a no vote is to recommend. Any other discussion? All right, you want to call the roll, Mr. Raddatz?
Mr. Smetana?
Yes.
Ms. O'Brien?
Yes, I do not think that the standards 1, 3, five, six, and eight have been met.
Mr. Burney?
Yes.
Chairman Martin?
Yes. And I appreciate Ms. O'Brien's listing the standards that have been met, and I agree on all of these. So the recommendation of the village to the Village Board of Trustees from the Zoning Board of Appeals will be that this variation not be granted. You have an opportunity to appear before the Village Board and discuss it with them when they take this matter up. So thank you for coming this evening. That concludes the variation requests for 346 Park. And the next matter on our agenda this evening is a request for a variation of 514 Ashland. We'll follow the same procedure. If you want to make a presentation, that would be fine. Just identify yourself.
Hi, good evening, members of the board. Thank you for hearing my case. Steve Glinky, petitioner for 514 Ashland. We are requesting relief from Section 10-9-5. We are requesting to extend lot coverage from the statutory threshold of 30% to 34%. We currently have a arts and crafts bungalow. I have photos of the subject property within my application. And the reason we are making this request simply is because we are we're enamored by the property. We're obviously a little bit biased, and I think that the unique nature of this particular property, unique in the sense that you don't see another property like this in River Forest, it would be exceedingly difficult for us to go ahead and reproduce a lot of the details. If you were to refer to photographs 1 and 2 in the application, you'll note specifically the dentist dental detail on the columns, the 3-foot rolling eaves. It's a stucco property. We have two children, a boy and a girl, and it is a traditional bungalow. It is a single bathroom with two bedrooms. So we are looking to expand to the west with a 513 square foot addition. We have about 199 square feet left in our structural coverage. And we are looking for approximately 314 additional square feet.
So I have a question for you. You speak of this as being a substandard lot. How did you determine that?
Well, it is. It's not a lot that meets the minimum lot criteria set forth in the zoning code. And in the interest of full disclosure, I happen to be the building department director and the zoning administrator in the Village of Forest Park. And I was given fair warning regarding that as not being a preferred hardship qualifier. So my preference would be to stress more the issues of aging in place and not affecting not harming the current architectural features of the existing structure. I know that process is different from Oak Park, River Forest, and Forest Park. It's a little bit like comparing apples and automobiles. So as I was preparing my application, I did happen to show it to several architects, one planner and a zoning attorney, and they all pretty much said the same thing. River Forest does not like that as a sole qualifier for hardship relief. I stand by that as a element of my hardship relief. Obviously, it is not self-imposed. But I really have no interest in engaging in an academic argument. I'd rather, I think, hang my hat more on the architectural detail of the property and the fact that it is exceedingly difficult in general to put a second floor on a bungalow and make it and retain some of that charm and natural beauty of bungalows. I did reference in my article, in my application, there are a number of bungalow preservation initiatives in the area. And one of the things consistently that they argue in force is putting a second story on the property. I think the qualifiers and of the other items of variation, there is no impact on light and air to the neighbors. I have neighbor support. I engaged a civil engineer to go ahead and do a stormwater study. Obviously, that's something that's going to have to be reviewed and confirmed by staff as accurate. But I, as I understand from my engineer, there are no adverse impacts on the property. And I do, frankly, understand the slippery slope of exceeding lot coverage. But I do understand that there is precedence within the village to help support that.
Cliff, can I ask you, so if this is a substandard lot, what is a standard lot? Why is this substandard?
There are a number of qualifications for for R2, the standard lot size. If you were subdividing new, which we're not doing here, but the minimum lot area for a new subdivision of a lot is 8,712 square feet, which is exactly 1/5 of an acre. And there's also a discussion about lot frontage, that you have to have at least 50 feet, but you're not required to make a frontage greater than 70. But for, lots of record that go back to antiquity, we don't even consider that in the terms of, any issue for review.
Well, I know that in the past where it's recommended that people have a garage, and where there have been substandard lots that we have allowed them to put a garage in to have it. This is a two-car garage you have on there now?
It's a three-car garage, yes.
Maybe before my time, in the 11 years I've been here, I don't think we've ever run into an instance where a garage was a problem for lot coverage. There's already there's a requirement for two enclosed parking spaces. The zoning ordinance provides relief on floor area for a detached garage of up to 500 square feet, but it doesn't provide any kind of relief in terms of lot coverage for the same.
I've seen the recall with that.
There may have been a variation before my time where, because I did ask that question when I was new here, and I asked 1,000 questions about the zoning ordinance, sometimes the same one over and over again. But I said, if somebody has to put up a garage and they're short on lot coverage, I mean, yes, they can put up two-car garage and, they pretty much have impunity at that time up to 400 square feet. But what if they're short on lot coverage? And I was told, oh, yeah, they will have to go for a variation. So there may have been instances of that before my time. I don't know.
So if this were a standard lot, would we still be looking for variation? What is considered a standard lot? We're getting down to splitting hairs, but what I'm trying to say is that
no, if it was deeper, if it was
Mr. Bernie, based on my calculations and the calculations of my architect, the answer would be we would not be here.
Yeah.
With the lack of, so have you done a water study, you know, like where the water would go?
I did. The architect's report is in there. Now, generally speaking, and this has been my experiences, engineers will not issue a narrative report. Essentially, what they do is document their findings, and it's the staff's responsibility to go ahead and confirm that. But verbally, it was reported to me that there is no stormwater issue.
Do you currently have any problems?
No, ma'am.
You're lucky.
If you will note also in the photographs, I think, you know, one of the things that we look for is uniformity in the neighborhood. I specifically put photographs facing north and south. The property, the principal structure itself is east facing, to indicate that building back will bring the structure line in line with the adjacent properties to the north and south. All other bulks, as far as I've confirmed with Cliff, are met on existing.
So it won't go any further or much further than both the north and south?
Again, you know, my field measurements were exactly that, field measurements. They will be at or approximately at. They will not exceed, grossly exceed. And as I mentioned, I do have letters of support from the adjacent properties included with my application.
Right, so Mr. Glick, you used a term that troubles me, and that term is precedent, because each application is supposed to be judged on its own merits, and, you know, not supposed to establish precedent for any subsequent application. And you know, the concern I have is that this application is looking to for a 10 or 12% increase in coverage over what is permitted under our code.
I'm sorry, a point of a clarification, it's 4%.
Well, but it's 4% of 30, isn't it?
It's 30. We're asking for 34%.
Yeah, you're asking for 4% above the 30%.
Correct.
Which is about
okay,
12% increase.
It's Common
right?
Core, sure.
Okay. Just different way of looking at numbers.
I understand.
So, you know, I think in the past, you know, when we look at something, one of the questions we ask is there anything you could do to this proposed addition to shrink it, so that you would still get the benefit of the of most of the addition, but we wouldn't be looking at something that was, you know, that large percentage over what's permitted in the code. I mean, you're asking for 500 and some square feet, if
right.
I remember correctly.
Correct. We have a galley kitchen. It's about 8 feet wide and about 12 feet long. So this is a combination master suite and an enlarged kitchen. It is, by any measure, a modest addition. We're looking to meet current and future needs. I don't believe my wife and I are anticipating increasing the size of our family. We've been here many, many years, and I think that you know, what we have planned here is going to meet future needs, and frankly, my family moved here in 1964. I have no intention of leaving. Modest would be my, I think, a good description of this. With respect to precedents, you certainly have the option to forget that I ever said that, but I guess perhaps I'm referring to my work in Forest Park, which is, if you can call it a more schizophrenic housing stock. There's far less uniformity, and I understand the slippery slope of the lot coverage issue. better than, I think, you know, I'm applying personal experience to something that is on a more standard lot. Frankly, that is the standard for the 5, 6, and 700 blocks of Ashland.
Is
the 50 by one?
160 or whatever, it's 150.
It is, yeah. Yes.
Is there a basement under this addition?
Yes, ma'am. But our FAR is well under what the code prescribes. In fact, that's a metric that, frankly, I'm not particularly familiar with. We don't use that in our community.
So basically, in answer to my question is, you don't want to reduce this addition in any way that might bring it closer to the permitted area of coverage under our code.
I think really the only option, I mean, I do believe that we have, if you go to the site plan, I'm sorry, go to the first floor plan. The dimensions of the master suite are, again, I think quite modest. If you want me to cut out a walk-in closet, or I don't know that I can reduce the dimensions of the bathroom. It is not a audacious addition. I think it is actually quite conservative, I think we took that in mind during the design phase of this process.
Okay.
Did you construct the garage, or was it there when you acquired the property?
Interestingly, the history. My wife had the house before we got married, and it was before I moved in. The driveway was on the north side of the house, and it was 7 feet wide, and it met a mid-lot one-car garage. I have a construction background. I wanted a bigger garage, and frankly, the traffic issues relative to our proximity to St. Luke's sort of made it necessary for us to go ahead and flip the driveway, frankly, at great expense, and create a turnaround in the backyard. I don't know if you've been around St. Luke's during a busy wedding or school pickup and drop off, but it's kind of a mess. So that whole development was intended to accommodate, again, future needs. Our children are 10 and 11 now, but at some point they will be driving, so we will need a three-car or parking for three cars. Right now it's got about 9 bicycles and 2 cars in it. And so I do understand that there is a concern over the fact that the garage is in excess of 700 square feet. At the time when I built the garage, and I built it myself, I did want to build a two-story garage, but relief was not available at that time. The footprint would have been smaller. I built to a dimension that I felt, frankly, if I could have, I probably would have built lot line to lot line. Guy's got to have a big garage. But I do understand your concerns.
Anything else you want to tell us?
I'm happy to answer any questions, but I think the responses to the standards of variation, if anyone has any specific questions regarding that, I'm happy to address those at this time.
All right. There's nobody in the audience who wants to sign up to address this, so we'll thank you for your time this evening, and we'll consider this and make a recommendation to the Board of Trustees.
Very good. Thank you.
Any discussions, any concerns about this application?
So the whole addition is 21 by just over 22 feet, then. Am I getting this right here?
It's kind of a T-shape, if you will. It kind of goes like...
Well, this is part of it, too.
Right, and it goes like that, and then...
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
Okay. And these are stairs.
All right, anybody have any concerns? Anything they want to say? Anybody, everybody ready to vote on it?
I would just like to say that, yeah, you know, we've gone through this thing about, you know, the hardship should not go, come from anything that might change, but has to go with the property. I feel that having a substandard sized lot creates a problem in terms of making a fitting in with modern living, let's say, you know. So, and since this addition kind of lines up with the other house next to it and everything, and this was a complaint from other people in the past where an addition went on and someone said, I won't be able to see the street now because now they're going to block my view. I don't think there's any of that going on here. So I don't have a problem with granting something like this based on that there is a hardship existing. And I would be comfortable in granting the variation.
Yeah, I agree with David. If a standard lot is around 178 or 180 deep, and these are 157, if it was on a typical size lot, they wouldn't be here. So I think that's probably the only reason that they're here is because their lot is short.
Cliff, I got a question for you. The application says that the proposed variation is 33.9% lot coverage.
Yes.
Your memorandum to us says that it's 34.06 lot coverage.
That was a difference in calculation between myself and the architect, and when I sent the notice out, it was based on my calculation.
And that the notice is the one that says it's 35.06.
Right. That was.
So what number? What's the number? What's the right number?
I think eventually the thing was is that we did come. It was a certain amount of a lack of dimensioning on the architect's drawings. And re-familiarize myself here. In mine was 0.1% of the lot area.
Well, why don't we do it? What number are you looking for?
I'm thinking.
Well, we'll just ask.
0.39, but I'm happy to round it up to 4.
Okay. So whatever the square footage is that gets to 33.9%, that's the variation you're looking for.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. All right, any discussion? Any questions? Right, we ready to vote?
I'd like to make a recommendation that we allow the variation request for I-14, Ashland.
Okay. It's been moved. Is there a second?
I'll second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that we recommend to the Village Board of Trustees that the variation to the appropriate section is to 33.9% lot coverage. Is that fair? Any discussion? All right, you want to call the roll?
Chairman Martin.
No.
Mr. Burney.
I vote yes. I think a hardship exists.
Ms. O'Brien.
Yes, I agree with Mr. Burney. I think having the lot depth be 157 is a hardship that they can't do anything about.
Mr. Smetana.
I look at item two and it says the aforesaid unique condition did not result from an action of any person having an interest in the property. I feel that, unless I'm misinterpreting something, they added lot coverage by building the garage, and it adds to the total lot coverage, unless I'm misinterpreting.
No, you're not misinterpreting.
And by applying the standards, I don't feel that I can, I don't think I can, I think I have to say no.
All right, so we're supposed to make a recommendation to the Board of Trustees, and we've been told, is this a sufficient recommendation that there is no recommendation? That
the
motion doesn't pass?
It will just go forward as a no recommendation with a tie. That's the best you can do.
Okay. Okay. So that's the, there will be no recommendation to the Village Board of Trustees. There will be the minutes and the findings of fact eventually will be prepared and presented with the non-recommendation. And you're welcome to appear before the Village Board of Trustees and make your case to them.
Better than no. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So that finishes, that concludes the Ashland property. We've got items two and three, the findings of fact in the minutes. Those have already been disposed of and weren't necessary to put on here. So now we're going to look at item number four, which is a text amendment. And our counsel is going to give us a very quick summary of what it is that we're trying to do and why we are being asked to do this.
Here we go.
There you go. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been involved with small cell for about a year now, and I've get kind of wordy about it, but I'm going to take your advice and try to keep it very short here.
Tell us, first of all, what is a small cell?
Right. I just want to give you some context as to what we're talking about. So small cells are, I handed out some pictures there. You're all familiar with kind of the macro towers, the traditional big cell phone towers with the antennas at the top. Small cell installations are something different. They started in about 2012 as a way to supplement the coverage that those big towers were giving. They typically consist of an antenna on top of an existing utility pole and an equipment box partway down the pole. We've got some pictures in here that show you some samples. You see one on the left that's actually located in Hinsdale on the first page there. That's something that T-Mobile recently put in there. With the antenna, that cylinder at the top is the antenna enclosure, and there's an equipment box partway down. The middle one is an installation in St. Charles. The one on the right is a street light in Schaumburg, and those are all examples of what these might look like.
So these are not new poles?
These are not new poles. Now, there may be instances where we're going to have new poles, and I'll talk about that in a second. The reason that we're here, though, the reason these are coming to the forefront right now is the telecommunications industry, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, et cetera, are getting ready to roll out a 5G network. So if you look at your existing phone, and up in the upper right-hand corner of an Android phone, at least it says 4G next to your bars, which is the current network that we're all on. And if you go back in time to like 91, it was 2G. It was only really dealing with texting. 1998, 3G came online. And then since 2008, the telecommunications industry has been 4G. And each one of those iterations has added new things, new capabilities like streaming video and texting capabilities. And 5G is a big step forward that the telecommunications industry is all very excited about. It's going to have things like ultra high def video. The big thing that it's going to do is have the capability to support all these smart home functions. So we see now like these wireless thermostats and smart refrigerators and smart dishwashers and washers and dryers. I was even at somebody's house recently where they had a wireless meat thermometer. So the turkey's in the oven and they're checking the temperature on their phone and they're getting a signal from the meat thermometer. So 5G will be able to handle all that, and even steps into the future like driverless cars. Okay, so 5G is coming, and the way that the telecommunications industry has decided that this is going to be implemented is not by construction or more of those big towers, but by these small cell installations. So they went, their strategy, instead of working through the federal government as they have in the past, their strategy in this case was to roll out these bills in all 50 states that give them a right to kind of put these on existing village infrastructure and in cases where there isn't infrastructure to put it on, to put up new poles in rights of way and in other places. And to not provide much say-so to the municipalities as to where these go, our ability to say no, et cetera. So they introduced that legislation in the Illinois General Assembly over a year ago, and I won't bore you with the fight that went on, but there was a lot of back and forth. It failed at one point. There was further negotiations that took place last fall, and it was eventually approved, a version of it. That did make some concessions in municipalities that made it slightly better, but the problem was it started from such a bad place that it really didn't end up as something that municipalities would favor, because we have proprietary rights traditionally over our own infrastructure. We don't want people sticking stuff on it. And we've been able to get money, monthly payments, when we did agree to have things put on our infrastructure. And this legislation limits those abilities, okay? But it was passed. It was signed by the governor in April. And it does a number of things, but particularly for your interest, it limits our zoning authority. So these are permitted uses under the Act in all public rights of way, which includes streets and the parkways, as well as what's called compatible utility easements. So if ComEd has lines running through the back of yards, they have the ability to do installations in those locations as well. They also have to be permitted uses in zones that are exclusively commercial or industrial. And so in that case, in your case, I think it's only the C1 commercial is the only place where we had to make it a permitted use on those private properties as well. So the village board has approved a whole new chapter to the public rights of way title of the village code that implements all the aspects of the act about permitting these, how the application process works, design standards and approvals, all that kind of stuff. And so that's in place, but part of this step that we also wanted to do is to address the zoning aspects of how these are handled from a zoning perspective, especially in those cases where they're not permitted uses, which is everywhere but the C1 and in the rights of way. And so we drafted a code amendment that that looked at the zoning code and made just some basic changes to address these, distinguishing these small wireless facilities from cellular telephone antennas and antenna equipment. We want to keep those existing provisions for the cases where we do have the big towers or other types of installations that are not fall within the definition of small wireless facilities. We have height limitations under the Act and built into the new chapter. So we have a reference here to those height limitations as opposed to the ones that are within the zoning code. And then lastly, we make amendments to the use chart. If you flip over to the page I gave you, you'll see that we're going to make them special uses on private property everywhere but C1. So that in the event that, say, AT&T wants to put an installation on private property and doesn't qualify as a right-of-way and it's not in the C1, they have to come before the appropriate commissions, and we can impose conditions just like we traditionally would on that particular installation. Part of what the design standards aren't under your purview, but what we've done is try to create some design standards that the village is going to implement and give to these telecommunications providers so that when they do come and put these up, they look good and not terrible, as good as they can, so that, you know, we've got some shrouding and kind of integrating it into the design of our existing poles. So these are going to become much more commonplace as 5G rolls out in the next couple of years. And so we're just getting the things in place right now that implement the Act and get our zoning codes up to par, so we're ready to go when the applications really start rolling in.
So why do we have to go through these amendments if there's a state statute that already says that we have to do this?
Because we took the state statute and we implemented it through this new chapter that we did, but we built additional things in here, and what we're trying to do is take this and give as much municipal protection as we can. So for instance, there's nothing about enforcement, permit enforcement in here, so we put a whole section in here about how we can revoke permits if certain things happen. Abandonment, what we can do if these are abandoned, how we can use our nuisance ordinances and take them down after sending notices. So what we tried to do was give as much protection to the municipalities as we could. You don't necessarily have to adopt something, but if you don't, they just have to default to the base standards that are in the state law, which are and those are in all cases are not going to necessarily protect you. And the best thing, the area where we have the most control, is these design standards again. And so if we say in our ordinance we're adopting written design standards and these need to be followed or you're not going to get a permit, that's an effective way to get the most control we can out of this bad situation.
So if they meet these design standards and whatever other application requirements are, they, as a matter of right, can put these small cell, small wireless facilities into any publicly owned property.
Right, they're primarily in the rights of way, so they're right. Going to want to utilize. Well, first of all, they're going to be very interested in putting them on ComEd poles. That's kind of been their traditional location, and you see an example of that one in the Hinsdale that I pointed out.
They can do that, so they have to pay us, if they put it on our poles, $200 a year, which is not much, but it's up significantly from the $20 a year they originally proposed. But under ICC regulations, if they do go on a ComEd pole, they only have to pay about $15 a year. So they're going to be more interested in putting them on ComEd. ComEd's used to working with them. There's requirements that the ComEd has to allow them in most cases. But then they do have instances. We met with AT&T, village staff and I recently, and AT&T is bringing forth their first application on these, and they want to put it on a streetlight near Harlem and Lake. They said they would work with the village on, you know, design and alternate locations if we're interested. We don't have the ability to force them into alternate locations, but we can, if they're voluntarily working with us, we're going to take advantage of that. And so, yes, they are going to go in the right of way.
Right, and when they're a permitted use in C1, they don't have a right. They don't have a right to put the facility in without the consent of the owners.
That's correct. Right? If they need the private landowner's permission. And so I don't think that's going to be a common occurrence, but there may be a situation where a business is willing to give them rights to attach, and they're not bound by the $200, so it's not going to be something that AT&T or Verizon are going to seek out, because they're going to have to pay more. The going rate traditionally for small cells has been about $250 a month for attachments.
Do you have any sense from a technological standpoint how dense these are going to be? Like, how many do they need to put up in a specific area?
Yeah, in densely populated areas like this, we are talking anywhere from 150, every 150 to 300 or 400 feet. And all the different carriers are going to want them. So there are, over time, there are going to be a number of these. And it may well be, you know, right now they kind of stick out to us because we're not used to them, but we don't notice the telephone poles that much anymore, right, or those sorts of things. I mean, some people might, but we've all gotten used to these things over time, so it may be something that we don't notice much in the future, especially if the designs are good. But right now, we can anticipate that there's going to be a number of these, and they are going to stick out some.
My son does site acquisition for the cellular.
Okay.
And so I was asking him about this, and one of the first things he says, you know, these things were usually going for a couple $100 a month, and now that they got the state law, it's like $200 a year. So, you know, people were happier to have these things around. Also, he said, we have like cement poles. He said, we'll not attach the cement pole, so our street lights don't fill the criteria. But the, you know, the Edison nice, big, beautiful poles will probably wear hats like these, you know, and that one. That's probably what they would look for. So as you would drive along a busy street, you would find one right up there.
Right. So they're saying they can get one up there and it can cover about a 3-block area,
yeah,
that might cover a good portion.
See,
of the village.
1, 2, 3. We're pretty close. I'm pretty close to Ashland. I'm voting for put them on Ashland.
And then where we have like decorative street lights, they're part of the design requirements are going to be, you know, if we can get the equipment,
yeah,
into the base of the street light so you can't see it, that eliminates the equipment box. If we can build the antenna enclosure on top so it looks just kind of like a seamless extension of the pole, that can work in some cases. You know, I think on the second page I have an example of you can see that decorative street light. Now that may not look great, we may be able to get a better design than that one in the middle, but it's an example of...
I thought that was a police camera.
It'll scare everybody. Everybody will be driving very slow. So kind of, because I look at these antennas always out in Phoenix, Arizona, and they have them designed like a palm tree.
Yes.
They have the tree.
There's cactuses. And I was actually in Door County, Wisconsin last week, and I saw one mast as a pine tree.
Yeah.
It's a fake pine tree about 40 feet high. And I took a picture of it.
I've seen that in Vermont. They have
that. Yeah. So they could do all sorts of things. So, if we
and
could get them on your site. And you want these anyway.
Right. So that's part of the pitch from the telecommunications industry is your residents are going to want this. They're excited. The reason we're not excited about it is because it's infringing on our traditional.
We're not going to get anything for it either.
Yeah. So, at any rate, we need to pass these text amendments.
So what are we asked to vote on?
We're just looking for, any text amendment to the zoning code needs a public hearing. So that is the purpose of us publishing and talking about this tonight, and we just need to move this along.
And is there the definition of small wireless facility that's...
That's straight out of the Act, and it's built into the chapter. So that's a cross-reference to the chapter the Village Board has already enacted.
Okay. So basically, we're cutting out the small wireless facility from these earlier definitions
right.
and creating its own definition.
Yeah, so we can keep the regulations in place that we have for the big cell towers and other installations.
And they don't get to go any higher than the current zoning code allows?
Under the Act, they have the right to be up to, if they put up a new pole, so if we don't have an appropriate place and they want to put up a new pole, it can be up to 45 feet high or as tall as the existing utility pole within 300 feet that's in the same right-of-way. So, if we were talking on Ashton or somewhere where maybe they were taller than 45 feet, or on North Avenue, for instance, somewhere where they're bigger, they may be able to go up to that height.
Right. But all we're going to vote on tonight are these proposed amendments to the zoning.
Right. Everything else is kind of at the Village Board level.
Was there anything else that we need to consider or you want to tell us about these proposed amendments before we vote on them?
So I went through them briefly. Like I said, for cellular telephone antenna and cellular telephone antenna equipment, we're kind of accepting out the small wireless facility, saying these are different. These are not cellular telephone antennas or equipment. We have the cross-reference to the definition in the new chapter of the Village Code. And the reason we use a cross-reference there, we typically try not to put two definitions for the same thing, one in the zoning code and one in the Village Code, because then you forget to change one and all of a sudden they're different if things should evolve. The height, again, so we have a number of things that are exempted from the height, the bulk height requirements in particular zoning districts, and we're adding these because they're separately regulated. Under state law, we have to allow them up to these certain heights. So again, that's what we're saying. Height for these is regulated by this new chapter of the Village Code. And again, for protection, we're making them special uses in all the zoning district except C1.
So that means if they want to install one, a non-publicly owned facility in the R1 district, they have to come before us,
and we can put conditions on it. Everything's fair game at that point to get a little more design control, et cetera.
Right. Anybody have any questions? Tagger?
No, I don't think so.
No.
Are you here to talk about this?
No.
Okay. So we have overwhelming public comment on this. All right, so somebody want, what is the appropriate motion that we should consider?
Motion to recommend approval of the zoning code text amendments regarding small wireless facilities.
All right, somebody want to make that motion?
I'll make the motion.
All right, is there a second?
I second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that we recommend to the Village Board of Trustees that they approve these proposed zoning code text amendments. Any discussion? Want to call the roll, please?
Mr. Smetana?
Yes.
Ms. O'Brien?
Yes.
Mr. Burney?
Yes.
Chairman Martin?
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
That's it on the agenda. Do we have a motion to dismiss?
Motion to dismiss.
Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right, we're adjourned.